Chair and panel, in the course of this hearing, you have heard a considerable volume of evidence. In this closing, we can only touch upon some of the most significant points raised on behalf of our clients. Firstly, Cheetham School of Music. You heard the moving evidence of A1 and A2. For the many former Chet's pupils around the world who were listening to this evidence, their words struck a real chord. You heard the manipulation and coercion they experienced at the hands of Christopher Ling. You heard how the environment and culture of the school, and especially the attitude of their housemistress, facilitated that abuse. You heard A1 and A2 describe the total isolation and lack of support they experienced at Cheetham's when their abuse came to light. Of course, A1 and A2 are just two victims amongst many from Cheetham's. You have also been provided with the powerful statements of our clients A3, A4 and A5 and the testimony of other victims. Some of those victims, like Frances Andrade, are tragically no longer here to give voice to their experiences. Given what we now know of the culture of this school, the suggestion that any of Christopher Ling's victims were consenting to their abuse is not only ludicrous, but utterly insulting. The harm that our clients have suffered as a result of the abuse is obvious. It is also very clear that this harm has been greatly compounded by the failure of the school to respond with even a modicum of human sympathy. The evidence of the three former head teachers at Cheetham's was also listened to by many, but it was listened to with utter incredulity. John Valens was the headmaster of Cheetham's when much of the most serious abuse was occurring. He was ignorant, he claimed, of sexual abuse which was occurring on his watch and which former pupils such as Ian Pace say was widely known and talked about throughout the school over many years. When confronted with the reality that he must have known or suspected that abuse was occurring, he hid behind the following bizarre formulation, and I quote, "It would be idle of me to deny that it is evident from the subject of this inquiry that there were bad things happening which I did not know about and I should have done." Our clients are of the view that John Valens adopted approach of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. You then heard from Peter Huller. He was even more brazen. He came before you under oath and tried to tell you with a straight face that it was justified to have claimed that Michael Brewer left Cheetham's because of ill health. We will address this further in written submissions, but we will be inviting you to conclude that he lied to this inquiry. We then heard from Claire Morland. She was happy to describe Peter Huller's actions as a cover-up, but was unable to acknowledge her own shortcomings. Despite claiming to be committed to, quote-unquote, blistering transparency, her response to the inspectors demonstrated the exact opposite. You will remember that in 2013 she failed to disclose a number of suspensions and disciplinary proceedings in response to a direct question about this. This omission led Elizabeth Coley to describe Ms. Morland's omission as quote-unquote dodgy. By the standards of inspectors, this is about as harsh a judgment as it gets. Ms. Morland's primary interest was not in protecting children, it was in protecting the reputation of the school and giving the appearance of progress on child protection without being honest and transparent with the inspectors. This hearing has exposed Cheetham School of Music in a deeply disturbing light. At the start of this hearing, those representing the school delivered a very carefully worded apology. That apology will be utterly meaningless unless the school in the future commits to real transparency about its failings and to supporting the victims and survivors who it has so grievously injured and failed over past decades. The next few months will show whether it has any serious intention of doing that or whether its apology was simply designed to placate this inquiry. We then move on to the Purcell School. It is clear from the evidence we have heard that for a number of years the school was presided over by a headmaster who was totally unfit for that role, indeed for any role in teaching. It should be a cause for real concern that within this sector a man like Peter Crook could rise to the headship of a major music school. Even more worryingly in our submission was the response of the Chair of Governors. Mr. Smallbone's evidence was hopelessly contradictory. He sought to persuade you on the one hand that Peter Crook's talk was, and I quote, very good with only minor exceptions. Yet when pressed by inquiry counsel on the detail of the talk, he acknowledged that most of what was said was wholly unsuitable and unacceptable. He was trying to have it both ways. He was trying to persuade you that he recognised the seriousness of what had occurred while trying to minimise his own role in silencing staff like Margaret Moore and Andrew Leverton, who tried to challenge it. He showed no remorse that the school had hounded and ultimately destroyed the career of a conscientious and committed teacher who clearly cared for her pupils. Again, the fact that he could become chair of governors at a major institution in this sector, despite his unsuitability for the role, demonstrates the need for drastic overhaul of governance. Since Peter Crook, Purcell's school has had 7 head teachers. You rightly queried why, and nobody was able to tell you. The current head, Mr. Bamber, acknowledged that the accountability structures at Purcell remain inadequate. He recognised the force of points raised by our client, Mr. Leverton, at the need for more parental input, for example. I hope that following these hearings, we will hear from Purcell an unqualified commitment to real change on those fronts, as well as their long overdue apology for these events. Moving on to special schools. You heard from our clients A6 and A7, who very courageously told you about the appalling sexual abuse they experienced. The principal of Appletree, Claire Davies, offered you a one-line apology for the abuse of A6. However, it was entirely unclear from the rest of her evidence what she was apologising for or what she had learned. She attempted to downplay the restraints and injuries A6 had suffered at the hands of staff. She did not appear to accept that staff at Appletree had failed to protect A6 and that her own systems had been at fault in allowing C1 access to abused children in bedrooms and when children absconded from school, despite clear knowledge of the risks C1 posed. She failed to acknowledge the reality that the abuse of A6 was preventable. It also became apparent in her evidence that the governance and accountability structures at Appletree to this day remain woefully vague and inadequate. She rather implausibly tried to persuade you that staff would be willing to challenge her on safeguarding issues if necessary. Yet Appletree operates on the basis that she runs it, her husband is the head teacher, and both are the safeguarding officers. The registered proprietors she described as an elderly couple in their 80s. She said they had very little involvement, if any, in the running of the school, yet also claimed they were able to advise her on safeguarding issues of the school. We say that the idea that you can have proper accountability, governance and independent oversight when all this is quite literally kept within the family is clearly absurd, and it insults the intelligence of this inquiry. It cannot be right that in 2019 a school is allowed to operate in this way. And frankly, it seems to us that it can only happen without outcry because the children who are placed there are children to whom society has decided to attach very little worth. It's absolutely imperative that you as an inquiry call out this scandal and ensure through your recommendations that organisations that are entrusted with the care of vulnerable children simply cannot be allowed to operate in this way without proper structures of accountability and oversight. With Stony Dean, Richard Nash from Buckinghamshire County Council was frank with the inquiry about the numerous failings of the local authority. On behalf of A7, we welcome his offer of an apology. Yet again, however, this apology only comes under the spotlight of this inquiry, and it comes a full 10 years after the serious case review highlighted so many failings of Buckinghamshire County Council in this case. We also welcome the therapeutic support he has again belatedly now offered to A7 and other victims of bully. However, it was notable that when pressed by inquiry counsel about the general availability of support packages for victims and survivors of child abuse, Mr. Nash was unable to point to a package of support in place, despite the specific recommendations of the serious case review from 2009. Despite the acknowledgement of the many failings of the County Council regarding the investigation of bullies' abuse of children at Stony Dean School, Mr. Nash's view that these events could not be repeated now was, in our view, unconvincing. The local authorities' procedures are still not up to scratch. The broader point here is that systems which ultimately rely on individual discretion rather than a clear mandatory duty backed up by sanctions for non-reporting cannot be relied upon. We end with some comments on the lessons of these hearings. Across a number of the institutions examined, the governance failures are obvious. Amanda Spielman described the independent sector as a quote-unquote permissive space where there are inadequate controls on the selection and suitability of governors. Too many institutions operated on outdated governance models and with governors focused on protecting the school's reputation rather than the protection of children. There is then the treatment of staff who try to raise concerns. You saw with Purcell how long-standing staff members were terrified to complain openly. We say that the only thing which would have transformed that situation is an unambiguous, clear legal requirement for safeguarding issues to be reported externally. There has been some talk in these hearings of introducing a duty of candour, similar to the NHS. We say that this is nothing like enough and there is no real evidence of the duty of candour making a meaningful difference in the health sector. On the contrary, research published in the Health Service Journal identified an ongoing failure by NHS trusts to adhere to the so-called duty of candour and a failure by the CQC to enforce it. The only thing that realistically would have protected Mrs. Moore would have been a mandatory reporting duty backed up by criminal sanctions for failure to report. We remind you that such a duty exists in other areas of the criminal law. Lawyers are required to report knowledge or reasonable suspicion of money laundering. This has the effect across the legal profession of overriding any pressure from the client. It has embedded a culture in which reporting of these matters becomes automatic. We need to do this with child abuse. It is also important to add, however, that reporting to the LADO can only work if LADOs have the training, capability and resources to do the job properly. It remains a real concern that there is, as we understand it, currently no national training or accreditation scheme for LADOs. Whilst they're supposed to be social workers by background, there's no requirement for this. We would suggest that an important recommendation of your inquiry is that this needs to change. Finally, the evidence of Helen Humphreys and Amanda Spielman highlighted several problems in the regulation of institutions tasked with the education and care of children. Inspection, said Amanda Spielman, is, and I quote, predicated on the integrity of the leadership of the school. As she put it, we are working in legal frameworks that assume that everybody intends to act honestly and well. Given the evidence of the last 2 weeks, that is clearly a fundamental problem. When you look at the inspection system in phase two, there is clearly significant further work to be done to ensure that one of the legacies of this inquiry is an inspection system which is truly fit for purpose. Chair, those are some of the points which we wish to highlight. We will develop them in our written submissions. We end by putting on record our thanks to the inquiry staff who have supported our clients professionally and compassionately during the process of giving their evidence. Most of all, we want to finish by paying tribute to our clients who had the courage to give their accounts by way of written statements and by oral evidence in some cases. In their interests and in the interests of future generations, we hope that these hearings can lead to real change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harrison.